Friends, Labor Day is past. The days and nights are starting to get a little cooler. The children have mostly returned to school. Amy Shaw, your minister, and up until quite recently, has moved to Iowa and is starting a new ministry there in Des Moines at First Unitarian. And the Green Bay Packers will play not their first, but their second game of the season beginning today at noon. So there is little doubt, it seems to me, that fall is indeed here, that the seasons indeed are inexorably turning as they do, and we with them. So, to help us come a little more fully into the fall season and to a little more fully embrace the inevitability of change in our lives, let me begin today with a story. The first of three stories, a spring story, a summer story, and a fall story, each about the inevitability of change, the ongoing procession of life, and the importance of our being more fully present to our singularly wild and precious lives. So, first, the spring story. Imagine that it is spring. It is the last performance of a local high school's production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. It is May. School is almost out. The kids involved in this particular drama program, and for that matter, in any good extracurricular program for that matter, tend to become very close to one another. If it gels, it becomes a close-knit group at best. So in this case, there is a lot of emotion on the stage that night and in the audience, especially at this last performance, and especially, of course, for the graduating seniors. The numerous curtain calls, which had been anticipated and rehearsed, ran about 10 or 15 minutes. In the end, prompted by one of the male leads in the show, both the cast and the audience are singing in full voice. They are singing for their lives. And then, at the very end of the last of the curtain calls, presumably unrehearsed, the male lead goes down on his knees, kisses the stage, and begins to weep. And he continues to weep now backstage in a cathartic release of joy, sorrow, grief, and perhaps bewilderment. This experience, this community, these friends, this stage, these teachers and people have meant so much to him. But now he knows. He knows that now it is time to let go and to find a way to move ahead, to move on. Our second story is a summer story. It, too, is about the inevitability of change and the ongoing procession of life. It's a story told by a former parishioner of mine, a wonderful woman who lives in Muncie, Indiana, where I once served. Her name is B. Souza. She first wrote up this story for her church newsletter, having just recently attended her first Unitarian Universalist General Assembly, which is essentially the annual meeting of our denomination. So B. Souza begins her account like this. "500 of us had been milling about, putting our PVC banner poles together, making appreciative comments about each other's banners, preparing for our entrance to the General Assembly opening session. As a first-time participant in GA, I was expecting a quiet, dignified parade to the singing of hymns. Two women and a man then rushed up the center aisle to where a small cluster of people had gathered about 60 feet away from where I stood. It took a few minutes for us to realize the seriousness of the situation. A fellow delegate had apparently suffered a heart attack. I could see the bobbing heads of the doctors doing CPR as one tired, another one took over. After about 20 minutes, they all stopped. There's no pulse, I heard someone say. They conferred briefly, and then one started again. By now, the EMTs had arrived with oxygen and other equipment. A little while later, with respect to the heartbeat, I heard, "It's faint." More time passed. The clear voice of a woman minister near me led us in a prayer. All was quiet. Finally, the medical personnel turned the man on his side and back again onto a slender red board and lifted him up onto a wheeled gurney. The victim's face was ashen and blended into his gray hair and beard. The clear voice rose again, this time in song. Without a moment's hesitation, 500 voices joined in. "Spirit of life, come unto me." We sang it once, twice, three times as the medics wheeled our nameless companion out of the hall. Overwhelmed, I heard more than sang the words. A woman behind me sobbed. I handed her my last tissue. As quickly as the crisis started, our part of it was over. All we could hope was that our combined thoughts, prayers, and singing could help restore the spirit of life to the fallen man as well as to the rest of us in the hall. A sense of awkwardness came over us, B. Souza continues, as we made the transition back to what we had come to do, a transition clearly uncomfortable for some. A young woman quickly volunteered to carry the man's banner, and we sent her through the crowd to be the first in the parade. And then off we went to do what we had come to do, serpentining down the halls and around corners, to emerge suddenly in flashing lights, rousing music, and clapping by an enthusiastic GA crowd. I was utterly stunned. This was not at all what I had expected. the 3,000 people in the plenary hall had no idea what had happened or why the Fort Collins banner came to be the first in the parade. This story, I want to suggest this morning, can be viewed as a metaphor for our lives, especially when we are fortunate enough to be part of an ongoing community of memory and hope, like this Lake Country Unitarian Universalist community. In other words, we, all of us, singularly and together, are in a procession which is full of surprises, both backstage and in the great plenary hall of life. Indeed, our lives are laced with surprise and are full of stories, stories of heartache and unbelievable joy, stories of improbable love, stories of miscarriages, debauchery, and redemption. Our lives are filled with stories of discovery and stories of long, dark nights of the soul. Stories of failure and success, stories of doubt, abuse, and healing. And if we are lucky, or better yet, if we are intentional about it, we are in a caring community, again, such as this UU church community, where we can honestly share at our best these stories, and where, when one goes down, others do their best to gather around and come to our aid. In community, at best, everything stops from time to time. We sing, we pray, each in our own ways. We tell our wild and precious stories, and we share in the pain and in the glory of life. And then, as it must, the procession eventually dusts itself off, regroups, and moves on. Awkwardly, perhaps, but inexorably, out into the great plenary hall of life. And just as the other delegates did not understand why the Fort Collins banner was the first in the procession, so too, much of the rich texture of our lives is frequently hidden from view. Yet, within a trustworthy community, the stories of our lives are in sacred hands. Our third story is a fall story. It too is about the inevitability of change and the ongoing procession of life. The author is Kent Nerburn. It's a story about a taxi cab driver, and which is something I'm particularly partial to because I once drove a cab, taxi cab for 2 years when I was in college at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. While I studied philosophy during the day, I drove a cab at night and figured both were good preparation for ministry. So our fall story by Kent Nerburn goes like this. I drove the night shift. My cab became a moving confessional. Passengers climbed in, sat behind me in total anonymity, and told me about their lives. I encountered people whose lives amazed me, some who ennobled me, Some made me laugh, and some made me cry. But none touched me more than a woman I picked up at the end of the shift one summer at 5 a.m. When I arrived, the building was dark except for a single light in a ground floor window. Under these circumstances, many drivers would just honk once or twice, wait a minute, and then drive away. But I had seen too many impoverished people who depended on taxis as their only means of transportation. Unless a situation smelled of danger, I always went to the door. This passenger might be someone who needs some assistance, I reasoned to myself. So I walked to the door and knocked. Just a minute. It was a frail, elderly voice. After a long pause, the door opened. A small woman in her 80s stood before me. She was wearing a print dress and a pillbox hat with a veil pinned on it like somebody out of a 1940s movie. By her side was a small nylon suitcase. The apartment looked as if no one had lived in it for years. All the furniture was covered with sheets. There were no clocks on the walls, no knickknacks or utensils on the counters. In the corner was a cardboard box filled with photos and glassware. Would you carry my bag out to the car? She asked. I took the suitcase to the cab and then returned to assist the woman. She took my arm and we walked slowly toward the cab. She kept thanking me for my kindness. "It's nothing," I told her. "I just try to treat my passengers the way I would want my mother treated." "Oh, you're such a nice boy," she said. When we got to the car, she gave me an address written on a piece of paper, and then she asked, "Could you drive through downtown?" "It's not the shortest way," I answered quickly. "Oh, I don't mind. I'm in no hurry. I'm on my way to a hospice." I looked in the rearview mirror. Her eyes were glistening. "I don't have any family left, and the doctor says I won't have very long." I quietly reached over and shut off the meter. "What route would you like me to take?" For the next 2 hours, we drove through the city. She showed me the building where she had once worked as an operator of an elevator. We drove through the neighborhood where she and her husband had lived when they were newlyweds. She had me pull up in front of a furniture warehouse that had once been a ballroom where she had gone dancing as a girl. Sometimes she asked me to slow down in front of a particular building or corner and would sit staring into the darkness, saying nothing. Then the first hint of sun was creasing the horizon. I'm tired. Let's go now. We drove in silence to the address that she had given me. It was a low building, like a small convalescent home, with a driveway that passed under a portico. Two orderlies came out to the cab as soon as we pulled up. They were solicitous and intent, watching her every move. They had been expecting her. I opened the trunk and took the small suitcase to the door. The woman was already seated in a wheelchair. "How much do I owe you?" "Nothing," I said. "Well, you have to make a living," she insisted. "Well, there are other passengers, thank you," I responded. Almost without thinking, I bent over and gave her a hug. She held on to me tightly for a long time. You gave an old woman a little moment of joy. Thank you. I squeezed her hand, then walked into the dim morning light. Friends, it is fall. Once again, the autumnal rhythms of school and church, storm windows and football are fully upon us now, whether we are ready or not. So let us get ready. Amidst the inevitability of change in the ongoing procession of life, let us be mindful to regularly pause, to kiss the stage of our individual and collective lives, and to joyously find time to sing together. Let us laugh and weep together and collaboratively find our way. Let us serve and work for peace and justice together. Let us nurture our children and grandchildren together, and let us take care of our elders. Let us share the hidden stories, the hidden pain and glory of our lives together, and thus let us be aware, more fully aware, of the preciousness of our lives and of the time we still have left. For this, I would suggest, is holy ground. If and when we open our hearts and our hands to one another and to the Spirit of life. So may it be. Oh, and by the way, the gentleman from Fort Collins who had the heart attack, he survived. He went home.